The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The race for the top four and the race for Harry Kane. Fans return around the country. Some things are the same. Timo Werner being offside. Edinson Cavani being a delight. VAR being really quite odd. Some things feel slightly different. 22-man brawls in injury time and players being sent off and cheerio'd down the tunnel. Meanwhile, Ryan Mason says Harry Kane is excited about playing Aston Villa. But is he more excited about playing for Manchester City? Also today, Roy Hodgson calls time on Palace. There's the playoffs. And Richard Jolly is here to tell us quite how much time it takes to come up with the stats that have kept this pod going for the last few years. All that, plus players not being recognised while on holiday, an exciting title race in Luxembourg, and an excellent abuse of Barry's email address. Your questions as always, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Louis writes, "Hi Max, after listening to the Guardian Football Weekly podcast, I imagined Barry to have shoulder-length curly golden hair. I am gutted after seeing the podcast profile picture. Any chance Barry could alter his hairstyle to match his voice? Barry."
Well, there are quite a number of hair emporiums and wig shops in the locale of Brixton. So I could go and buy a long blonde wig if I wanted. If that's what the people want, well, so I can...
I think, you know, the listeners, after all, are more important. What they want is what we should do. And so I expect to see that on Monday morning. Thank you. Pete says, "Can we ignore all other football and just get Richard to give us his top 50 stats of all time, please?" Richard Jolly, welcome to the pod.
Yes, thanks, Max. Yeah, 15 years after first contributing to The Guardian, I've made it onto the pod. So I think in about 700 years' time, I could be editor of The Guardian at this rate of progress.
Well, thank you. Considering you've never been on, you have delivered a lot of content. So look, really, if you didn't say anything, I think you'd be well within your rights to go, "Look, I've done enough and I should have been on before." But you are welcome to contribute if you see fit.
Thank you.
Great. Jordan Jarrett Bryan, live from Uganda. Hello, Jordan.
Hello, mate. How are you? You all right?
Yeah, I'm good. What are you doing in Uganda? Spreading the football weekly message.
Obviously. Got some fans outside the door right here, just listening with, by the ear, by the door here, yeah, to see what's going on. They love it. They love it. Love it.
Okay, let's start then with the race for the top four. Chelsea 2, Leicester 1. It means Chelsea have 67 points from 37 games. Leicester 66 from 37 and Liverpool 63 from 36. And Barry, I mean, fans being there and fans being at all the games yesterday seem to make a difference. I don't know if I'm just getting sort of caught up in the cliched nonsense of it all, but it sort of felt to me like Chelsea were more up for this because of the fans being there.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of cliche nonsense and people getting very overwrought by the mere sight of more than three people gathered together in the same place. But I definitely think it made a difference in certainly two of the games I watched over the last couple of days since Monday. I think Chelsea fed off the energy of the crowd and... I'm slightly surprised they only won 2-1 in that game against Leicester. They were vastly superior over the 90 minutes when it really looked like the gods were conspiring against them for a while in that first half. And, well, the gods and Timo Werner. But maybe if the crowd hadn't been there, that would have got to them and their heads would have dropped. But I reckon they certainly fed off the energy. I mean, it could be balderdash, but that's certainly the impression I got.
You're saying the gods conspired against Timo Werner and Chelsea, or the gods conspired against Chelsea and Timo Werner conspired against Chelsea?
Yeah, the latter, yes. The gods and Timo Werner conspired against Chelsea. I mean, look, he's offside so often it's comical. He was unlucky not to get a penalty. God, he never stops trying, does he? And you can't fault him for effort.
Johnny Liu wrote, the Chelsea goal came from Antonio Rudiger, scoring the sort of goal that Timo Werner couldn't even buy on the dark web, which I thought was a brilliant line. Here's a question. I'm not just going to ask you stats-based questions, Richard, but Alex said, has a player ever had more disallowed goals in a season than Timo Werner? Should the Statos add a new metric, DG, to better record his contributions? Does the panel think he'll bounce back with a 20-goal season next time? I think, Richard, that He contributes so much to this team. And I think he really will if they persevere. People are start, even Johnny in his piece saying, it's time to start asking, actually, is this all he can do? But I think it will come good for him.
Well, if you look at his history, he scored 28 goals in the Bundesliga last season. And so to judge by the number of misses he's done in the Premier League, does that mean he had about 700 shots in the Bundesliga? By the law of averages, this man is going to score some goals soon. At the same time, it probably would help if someone else in the team was scoring, because at the moment their top scorer is Jorginho on 7, which are all penalties. And at the time of speaking and ahead of Sheffield United's game tonight, their top scorer is on 7 as well. But Werner, you're right, he adds a huge amount with his pace. He stretches teams. He's got a brilliant attitude. He does superb interviews as well. I mean, I think come the end of the season, there should be a sort of post-match interview off between Timo Werner and Patrick Bamford, because they're the two best post-match interviews in the Premier League.
Yeah, I get the impression that Werner's like a real nerd. I don't know, like when I was watching that interview yesterday, and you know, this comes from someone who's very square themselves, but like, I reckon he's like a real geek. I don't know why, but I agree with you on his interviews are fun and they're interesting.
And also, he's always willing to do them. It doesn't matter how many chances he's missed. He always seems to be the man who gravitates towards the cameras and the microphones, which is really quite endearing. Not too many other players do that these days.
I would love to see Timo Werner do a 5-minute open spot at a comedy club, because I think he'd be really terrible, but so terrible it would actually be funny.
The penalty incidents, Jordan, the one where he's his foot is kicked incredibly hard and then isn't given, everyone seems to think it should be a penalty. Although Chris says, if I go to hammer a nail into the wall and while I'm mid swing, someone sticks their hand in the way and I twat them on the hand, have I just caused grievous bodily harm? If so, how long am I going to jail for? I didn't mean it. This feels like a stitch up. I mean, I think, I'm not sure if that's a false comparison, but to me, that should have been a penalty and the other one shouldn't, actually.
I thought they were both penalties. I thought they were both penalties, to be fair. And the analogy that the listener puts in there, I think, is an apt one as well. But I do think that they were both penalties. And just kind of going back to Timo Werner and the interviews, I agree with Richard. I think like the fact that he's always so willing to speak to everybody despite having a shocker of a game, I think there's a lot about him, and a lot of players at my team could learn a thing or two from that as well. But also in terms of his prolificacy in front of goal, everyone keeps saying, you know, his movement's really good, he contributes, blah, blah, blah. And I was on that train for a little while as well. But how long do you kind of persist with a striker that's meant to be one of Europe's top strikers on the basis that he's got good movement? At some point, you're going to have to show that you can take these chances. And I think the pressure that Tuchel's going to be under next season, especially if they miss out on top four and lose the Champions League final, is going to be so high. He will need to be putting those chances away. So, I don't know, we can maybe write it off as a one season where he's kind of been bedding in and he's had a bad season. Next year, he'll come good. The stats say the chances he's creating and been involved in, he's got to convert at some point. But I don't know how long we can keep running with that train that he's contributing, he's got to score goals, and the moment he's not.
I mean, my feeling is that if you're getting off the train, I'm very much staying on the train. That's
save me a seat, please, Max.
I'm going to the buffet car and I'm getting the £8 meal deal, and I'm going to burn my mouth on that coffee, and it's been exactly the right decision. I wonder how many injury time melees we've missed, Richard, because there haven't been fans. It seemed to me that was, Chelsea were obviously time wasting, so everyone was just getting involved. I think Adam Hurry, you know, Football Cliches, was saying it was peacemakers and then meta peacemakers. No one was really doing anything. But I mean, we'll get onto the playoffs, but you went to the Barnsley game in the playoffs, didn't you? I just saw that sense, you know, I when watching the Barnsley game, the sort of fury and the booing that the Barnsley fans did every time an opposition fullback was just trying to steal a few yards for a throw-in. You know, that, you feel that melee last night was because the fans were there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and in terms of the peacemakers, it was good to see Kasper Schmeichel doing the classic goalkeeper run 60 yards only to get there after the melee's breaking up to then try and break it up a bit further. The best bit of the melee was that Mike Dean managed to book Daniel Amate, who didn't come on the pitch at all. Joining the illustrious list of people that Mike Dean has booked who actually haven't been on the pitch, I think the last one was Freddie Ljungberg, who he booked last year, about 13 years after he previously booked him. My favourite Premier League booking of a player who never got on was Dean Windass years ago when Stoke had come up and everyone was obsessed by Rory Delap's long throw. And so Dean Windass set about intimidating Delap as he geared up for these long throws. The referee booked him, and Windass reckoned that was why Phil Brown didn't bring him on in that game.
Sorry, just on the subject of Dean Windass, didn't he once get sent off in a car park after a game, I think when he was playing for Bradford?
I think you're right there. Yeah, that does sound correct to me. In his list of charges with the FA, sent off in a car park and booked on the sidelines.
Leicester could have got a point out of this game somehow, Barry. I mean, Iheanacho scored, the first player to score on every day of the week in a Premier League season, which is a great statistic, isn't it? And then Ayoze Perez had that chance. And it's funny to think, isn't it, in the kind of, who would you want to bank on for the one moment to decide the top four, if you had a choice of Ayoze Perez 10 yards out or Alisson lumbering up for a corner? He's got to score, hasn't he? Or he's got to hit the target at least.
He should have scored. It was a terrible shot. I think a match of the day too, Dion Dublin posited the theory that he was wheeling away in celebration before he'd actually hit the ball, which is why he put it wide. I'm not sure that's the case. But he should have scored. I do think Chelsea were very worthy winners of the game, though. It would have been an injustice.
I'm not sure what the exact figures are, but Leicester have been in the top four for a lot of the whole of this season and a lot of last season. To miss out again, Richard, would be it would be sad for them. But, you know, they're punching above their weight, I guess.
Yeah, I think the exact figures are 71 out of 75 match days over two seasons. Though that could even change when Liverpool play Burnley. The game that it reminded me of last night was when Wigan won the FA Cup 8 years ago. And then 3 or 4 days later, they had a big game at Arsenal. And obviously the situation was different because Wigan were trying to stay up, Leicester going for the top four. But it just felt that winning the FA Cup had taken such a huge physical and emotional toll on them that they didn't have anything else left to give. And it wasn't so much a lack of effort. It was just the fact that they were spent and Chelsea felt fresher. They felt stronger. They've obviously got a bigger squad and more resources. And Leicester just seemed to be hanging on and hanging on for quite a lot of the first half, obviously with the aid of Timo Werner at times. But you do feel it could be a very tough task to rouse Leicester for the last game. I do think there are parallels with last season. They ended last season short of players because of injuries to players like Maddison, Pereira, Chilwell. I think over the last few games, they've really started to miss Harvey Barnes. They've become very, very reliant on Kelechi Iheanacho's goals. And Harvey Barnes was in terrific form earlier this year. Ricardo Pereira has just not been back to anything like his best.
Well, yeah, there's been so much talk about whether if Leicester don't finish in the top four this season, if that will be deemed a failure off the back of another year occupying the top four for so long and then blowing it at the last minute, which I think is a little bit harsh. I think whilst it would be a blow to them, last year they were pushing for top four and dropped the ball at the last moment. This year, it would be pushing for top four, drop the ball at the last moment, but with an FA Cup in the bag as well. So I think it would be a little bit harsh to kind of deem this a failure season should they not come top four. I don't think they will. I think they might have blown it for a second year in a row now. But I think with the FA Cup in the bag, I don't think that necessarily... I think that negates what's happened in the league this season. I totally agree with Richard. My concern going into this game was that they might have, you know, the Man United game and in the cup final, this might have been one big game too many for them. But they actually weren't as tired looking as I thought that they might be. I thought that for the first hour at least, they looked quite sprightly. And then, you know, Chelsea were the better team and, as Barry says, worthy winners. But I don't think they lost this game because they were tired. I just think Chelsea were the better team. And just on Chelsea, I think it was a massive win for them because, as I mentioned earlier on, if they don't come top four and they don't win the Champions League against Manchester City, I fear that if they don't start the next season on fire, Tuchel will be gone by Christmas. Knowing Chelsea's history and Abramovich, if they don't finish top four, don't win the Champions League, and they don't start next season on fire, I think he's in trouble.
Well, you might be right. I mean, what's interesting is you shouldn't guarantee Liverpool two wins, because Burnley fans, as we saw from, you know, the fans, and we'll get on to Brighton next, you know, they will really want Burnley to win in this game. And for those of you who are listening to this pod before that game happens, I'm predicting Burnley will get something from it if that result has happened. Ignore this bit. So Brighton 3, Manchester City 2. Barry, I got quite emotional seeing the Brighton players and fans celebrating. I mean, I think we're allowed to, aren't we? But it was just...
Were you hungover, Max? Because you get emotional when you see raccoons eating fruit on YouTube. You're a very emotional man. You're very easily...
if I've had a few... And
jerked
then
into
morning.
A tearful state. Yeah, that sounds disgusting. Sorry.
Anyway, I thought it was a really fun game at the Amex. And for the Cancelo red card, Richard, I mean, I can't tell if that is a foul or not. I did love just fans screaming for a red card, getting the red card, and then singing cheerio to Cancelo. But I don't know if that's a foul or not.
I think it's probably a foul. Is it a red card? I don't know. I did enjoy the fact that it means that in the sort of great Premier League red card battle this season, the Jows are up to 2 red cards and the Johns are up to 3. So it's a real chance for the cosmopolitanism of the Premier League to strike out. The problem is we now need João Moutinho to get a red card in the last couple of games of the season, and he's only been sent off once in his entire career. So probably he won't get that. But it was also interesting in the knock-on effect of Manchester City going down to 10 men and Pep Guardiola taking the chance to go full Pep even more so than before by taking off Ferran Torres and not even having a false 9 at all, just having wingers and attacking midfielders and leaving these Brighton centre-backs there with absolutely nobody to mark and thinking what they should do. And for a while, I thought that worked very well. Obviously, the result would suggest otherwise, but I quite like that.
Matty says, have you ever seen a goal that looked more like it was scored by a giraffe than Dan Burn's effort tonight? And I know people have talked about Dan Burn being tall. And actually, I saw the question before I saw the goal, but it's absolutely right. It's really sort of a stumbling giraffe going through and then putting it away and then just lying flat on its back going, what more do you want? I'm a giraffe and I've just scored in the Premier League. Phil Foden's goal, Barry. And actually, his first touch, the way he sort of faints one way and then speeds off. There's no way England can't win the Euros, aside from Mbappe and Benzema playing together for France.
I think Phil Foden could have a future in the game. He seems quite promising talent. My favourite goal of this game, actually, and Phil Foden's goal was wonderful, but we wax lyrical about how great he is all the time. My favourite goal of this game was Leandro Trossard's. And I'll tell you why. It's because I have a real bugbear with footballers who cross for the sake of crossing when there's no one in the penalty area to get on the end of their delivery, and footballers who shoot for the sake of shooting when it's quite obvious their shot is going to be blocked. But Trossard waited and waited and waited when other players might have pulled the trigger, and then when there was a gap, then he shot and scored. And that is why I think his goal was better than Phil Foden's.
All right. Graham Potter and Pep had words after the game. Potter said, he was disappointed with me. I was over-emotional with our first goal celebration. It wasn't good for me. I apologise. It was just emotion. I was a bit annoyed with Potter for backtracking. He should have just said, oh, wind it in, Pep. You know, you've done it. But perhaps it's good tactically to stay on Pep's good side so that Pep can continually go around saying what a brilliant manager Graham Potter is, and then Graham Potter can get the Spurs job when no one else wants it. Manchester City owner Sheikh Mansour will pay the travel costs of all the fans attending the Champions League final. Well, the Man City fans, that is. Supporters purchasing tickets will be offered a place on the club's official trip to Portugal. City have received 6,000 tickets for the game. Against Chelsea on the 29th of May. The initiative is, quote, designed to ease the financial pressure on fans after the impact of COVID-19, said a statement Jordan.
I mean, you say that, or he says that, but I just think there's a lot of that of trying to mug off the Man United and Arsenal fans to show how good an owner we are in comparison to other football fans' owners. So yeah, it's a lovely thing to do, but there's a lot of football fans I know that are looking to stuff like that and saying that is how you treat your fans.
Is that we forgive you for the European Super League as well? You know, like, look, that was just an aberration.
I think there's a part of that in there as well. Yeah, they're trying to curry favour with the fans. Because I spoke to quite a few Manchester City fans at the back of the whole European Super League proposal / collapse. And when there was a lot of ire amongst the top six fans, Man City fans were saying to me, we don't align ourselves with Arsenal or Man United fans because we actually like our owners. Unlike them, we like our owners. It was just this one thing that we really detested. So I think there's a little bit of favouring to be kind of brought back towards the Man City fans, and this is probably going somewhere towards that. But yeah, there's no way the kind of ire that other groups of fans have towards their owners.
Manchester United 1, Fulham 1. Rhys says, after Cavani's goal of the season, mere hours after United announced their goal of the season, should teams wait until the end of the season before announcing their goal of the season? Seems like quite a sensible idea. Bruno Fernandes was awarded goal of the season before the game for his effort against Everton, which I confess I can't remember. But he scored some good goals this season. It was a thing of beauty. I loved how flat it was, Barry. And Edison Cavani is so dashing, even though, of course, the goal should never have stood.
Yeah, I'd have been very angry if that had been ruled out because it was a thing of beauty in an otherwise almost meaningless encounter. 10,000 Manchester United fans were in. First time Manchester United fans had been in Old Trafford for almost a fortnight, or just over a fortnight. But they deserved to that treat for turning up for a game that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot riding on it. If anything, Manchester United could have wrapped up second place, but second, third doesn't really make any difference, does it? But I thought it was a wonderful goal, and I would have been furious if it had been ruled out, even though it should have been ruled out.
Are you suggesting that if a goal is really good, it should stand, even if it shouldn't stand?
In a game between Manchester United and Fulham, where I don't have a dog in the fight, and the game, not even Manchester United or Fulham particularly had a dog in the fight, yeah, I think it should be allowed to stand, right, no matter how illegal it is.
Jordan?
I have my personal issues with Cavani. I didn't like how he conducted himself over the whole Instagram tweet. I didn't like how the Uruguayan FA came back and defended him and all that sort of stuff. So I've got my issues with Cavani. But that goal is an absolutely phenomenal goal. The finish, and as you say, the way he's kind of chipped it, but it's not like a loopy chip. It's a real direct chip. The keeper's not that far off his line as well. I think it's a brilliant goal. And I'm quite keen to see now they've re-signed him, Manchester United, what their strategy in the summer is going to be. Because we're going to get to Kane a bit later on, I believe. But if they've signed him, if they're keeping Rashford, who I accept can play wide, and Martial as well, where does a Kane fit if they're going to be spending that much money on wages on someone like Cavani? So I'm interested to see where they go with their front line next season on the back of re-signing Cavani.
Yeah, we'll talk about Kane in part two. Before we do that, we'll just finish on Leeds' win at Southampton. About a month ago, Leeds sort of had nothing to play for. Now they're in with an outside shot of Europe, most probably the conference plate that Jonathan Wilson changed my mind on in Monday's pod. And they were fun in a fun game that could have gone either way. Some Leeds fans still, and I know it's not many, but some sort of just they're so furious that Leeds haven't burnt out, and people said there might be burnout, but like I don't want to go down that. I had a nice chat with a Leeds fan who was happy. It turned out he was happy, even though his first question was, you see, we're not burnt out.
Leeds have actually played the fewest games of any season in their history, apparently, because they got knocked out of both cups in the first round, in both cases fielding their reserve team. So they've only played 38 games. But one thing that people have noticed around Leeds is that other managers talk about how far Leeds run as though it's some sort of unfair advantage they've got. And it's like, well, actually, you can run a lot as well if you choose. It's just that Leeds are incredibly fit and they keep on running. And so there is something quite symbolic about them scoring in about the 96th minute of the 37th game of the season. But in terms of Leeds, I think part of the difference in this run in and why they've kicked on has been that after those games earlier on in the season that cemented their reputation for fun, they've actually tightened up a lot at the back. They haven't had a 6-2 or a 5-2 or a 4-3 for quite a while. They've only conceded 9 goals in the last 13 games. At the start of the season, Diego Llorente was absolutely luckless. He was either injured or about to get injured or suffering a setback in coming back from getting injured. But he's actually had a run in the team. He's played very well. Pascal Struijk's had the best form of his Leeds career in the last 2 or 3 months. And I'm not entirely sure what Bielsa's done, but I think he's tweaked his tactics so Leeds are a bit less kamikaze and a bit better defensively.
Quickly, before we end part one, it is Spurs Villa tonight, and lots of people asking you, Jordan, and Shaman, for example, will, with Villa's performances fizzling out towards the end of the season, does Jordan feel vindicated?
Yes. And this game, I'm conflicted because, obviously, as an Arsenal fan, I don't want anything good to happen to Spurs. I actually just saw the airport when I landed here in Uganda, somebody wearing an Aston Villa shirt. And it was a Ugandan. And I was very close to going over to him and having a chat about his life choices as to why he's wearing... Anyway, it's a bit of a meh game. I think Spurs' aspirations of anything this season have gone. Villa have kind of petered out. But in answer to your question, yes, I feel completely vindicated that they're not a very good side and he's not a very good manager.
All right. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do Harry Kane and Roy Hodgson. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So, according to many reports, Harry Kane has told Tottenham he wants to leave. It came out on Monday. Spurs are apparently very angry about the timing of the announcement. Manchester United, Manchester City, Chelsea, all rumoured to be interested, as are Barcelona, despite having no money. They might be able to magic some money from somewhere. They've done it before. It's interesting, Jordan, isn't it? What do you think will happen? Daniel Levy is obviously known as a good operator, or whatever adjective you want to use. I mean, I think it has worked totally against Spurs so many times when he leaves it to the last minute to sell a player. They've got no time to buy players. He has no interest in selling Harry Kane, but there's believed to be a gentleman's agreement. What do you make of it?
I think Harry Kane has played a very, very shrewd and intelligent game here in how he's gone about this. What he's done here is he's put out these kind of feelers that I want to leave. Now he's saying I want to leave, but I need to be in a club that's winning big trophies. He's 28 years old. The time is now to be fulfilling my potential. And by doing that, what he's done is he's got the Spurs fans on side, who, if you speak to most Spurs fans now, they would agree, you know what, he's got to go. He's too good for us. And what he's also done is then made sure that Daniel Levy, if he makes this problematic or difficult, he's then the bad guy. He's the guy that the Spurs fans and the media are kind of like, oh, how dare you stop Harry Kane from, you know, fulfilling his potential. He's given a year, 2 years longer, arguably, than he probably should have. You've got to let him go. I have a feeling, I've said this for the last couple of months, I wouldn't be surprised if he's still at Spurs next season, because I don't see anybody putting up the 140, 150 that I think Daniel Levy's going to want. Daniel Levy has no problem in being the bad guy or the villain in this. If he doesn't get what he thinks Harry Kane is worth, I don't think, agreement or not, I don't think he lets him go. So, and there's also the element of, is it a foreign club or is it a club here as well? And also the Euros. I think if Harry Kane has a very, very good Euros and scores 6-7 goals, that in a weird way might backfire on Harry Kane, because again, it might make Daniel Levy think, well, I want 25 million more now, sort of thing. So I'm still kind of sticking to my guns that I think he'll be at Spurs next season, just because I don't see Daniel Levy caving into this COVID crisis or this pandemic kind of sympathy, or no one's got no money. I think he'll stand firm. I think he'll want his money. And I think that the best that can happen, I heard on Talk Sport, Simon Jordan proposed the idea that Man United, for example, may offer 60 million plus Martial and Bailly, something like that. That might appease him, but I think that Daniel Levy will dig his heels in, and he won't care about the game that Harry Kane is currently playing through the media.
I don't think you can call Harry Kane shrewd when he signed a 6-year contract that has 3 years left on it, because Daniel Levy knows he's the bad guy. He's been the bad guy for ages. He doesn't care. And, you know, this talk of a gentleman's agreement makes me chuckle because, you know, not everyone involved in the agreement appears to be a gentleman. Let's say. But, yeah, I think it's inaccurate to say that Kane holds the cards and is being shrewd.
Sorry, I think shrewd in the sense that I think he's made sure that he's protected his own PR. So whatever comes of this, he won't come out of this looking like the bad guy, the golden boy of English football. He won't come out looking like, I demanded a move. I'm disloyal to Spurs. I think he's played this quite well. But I agree with you, the power ultimately still is with with Spurs.
Richard, do you think there's an argument to say Spurs would be sensible to cash in and do it now? Because, you know, Kane isn't young. His ankles aren't the best. And if you could get money now, and this is the last time you're going to get a huge amount of money for Harry Kane. And if you did it early and got a manager who was good and said, here's some money, you could actually position yourself reasonably well.
Yeah, absolutely. There is that argument. The counter argument, which I think Jordan's expressed, is that who logically should pay £150 million for Harry Kane when he's about to turn 28, when his ankles are a bit dodgy, when the track record of clubs paying £80 million plus for a player, even in the pre-COVID era, there were very, very few successes. The Cristiano Ronaldo to Real Madrid are outnumbered by Eden Hazard to Real Madrid and Philippe Coutinho to Barcelona. And the other issue that I think Kane may have is that everyone's first choice should be Erling Braut Haaland and not Kane. And that is partly on grounds of age. But if you are Manchester City, for example, Haaland could play for them for a decade. And in a decade, he could get 400 goals, which might be bad news for Sergio Aguero because all of his records would be obliterated within a few years. But yes, in principle, if Tottenham can get in a very big sum, if they can do it early, if they can get a manager and if they can spend it well, if you put all of those ifs together, it could work out very well. I think Spurs fans might be a bit cautious because they will remember the precedent of selling Gareth Bale, and that whilst they spent all that money straight away, it didn't reap an immediate reward. Quite a few of the signings failed, even though Christian Eriksen went on to be a very, very good one. He was outnumbered by the others.
I mean, and you can't imagine, I think, Barry, Harry Kane downing tools, can you? Of all the players, you know, something that Levy will know is that if he ends up at Spurs at the start of next season, you just cannot. And even if he did down tools, he'd probably get 25 goals anyway.
Yeah, I think his ego would prevent him from downing tools. But if he did, Levy could still hang on to him for a season and get a decent fee for him at the end of next season. I mean, I've no idea what's going to happen. I'm inclined to agree with Jordan that he will be there at the start of next season. Whether he'll be there when the transfer window closes is none of the matter, but it is going to be unspeakably tedious, the whole soap opera, as it rumbles on and on and on. And I want no part of it.
You're right, aren't you? Roy Hodgson has decided to call it a day at Crystal Palace. He said, the time is right to step away from the rigours of top flight Premier League football, or medium flight Premier League football is a more accurate. He's been in charge of Palace since September 2017. I mean, actually, when you stand back, and I know that whenever we sort of joke about a boring Premier League game, it involves West Brom playing Burnley, playing Crystal Palace. Actually, what he's achieved with Palace is he couldn't have really done a lot more, could he, Jordan? What do you want him to do? Like every team they play against pretty much has a bigger budget. Can't play free-flowing football.
Yeah, no, as I think about it now, yeah, you're right. I mean, I've said for about 3 or 4 years that Palace squad, bar Zaha, is a championship squad. It's a top-end championship squad, bottom-end Premier League squad. So I suppose to make them, you know, between, you know, 10th and 15th every single season, he's done a very, very good job there. I've loved the fact that the perception of Roy Hodgson is that he's this dour, boring, archaic manager. But he has this really young, vibrant, Palace team over the last 3 or 4 years that produced some really good young players. And it seems to work. It really seems to work. Yeah, I think the time probably is for him to move on now. Where they go from here on in, I'm not quite sure. I know Lampard's been linked with the job. I think he will get the job. I don't think he should get the job. But yeah, it's a decent end to a very, very illustrious and I would say overall successful career for Roy Hodgson.
I feel like I talked you off a ledge there. I feel like you were sort of having a Boris Johnson EU moment there, Jordan, where like you could have said literally the opposite. This is an absolute disaster. I feel I've let the pod down by sort of pushing you towards sense. Richard, what's your sort of, you know, your view of Roy? He's quite an urbane, you know, multilingual, like intelligent guy who's done incredibly well. I think
his sheer longevity is a huge achievement in itself. I mean, he got his first managerial job in 1976, which was also the year of, you know, the first punk record. So maybe that makes Roy Hodgson the first and last punk rocker. But he doesn't deserve to be defined by the things that went wrong in his biggest jobs, because he wasn't a good Liverpool manager. And the result that stands out from his time in charge of England is obviously the Iceland game. But over the sweep of an entire career, there are some huge achievements there, often with lesser clubs and maybe with lesser players. You think of taking Fulham to a Europa League final. Probably no one will ever take Fulham to a European final again. He took Switzerland, I think, into something like the top four in the world rankings. He qualified them for the World Cup when they'd been nowhere for a long, long time. And he's actually had quite a lot of an influence in a way that maybe people don't appreciate. Jurgen Klopp was talking yesterday about how when he was a player at Mainz and his great mentor there, Wolfgang Frank, who played a back four at a time where everyone else in Germany played a sweeper system, he would show them videos. And a lot of the videos he showed them were Arrigo Sacchi's AC Milan, but some of them were Roy Hodgson's Switzerland. Now, nobody thinks of Roy Hodgson as a big influence on Jurgen Klopp, but the fact that he did have that role, I find it is interesting. Along with the fact that he's basically done the same for 45 years and everything else in the world has changed. But Roy Hodgson's just been this reassuring constant on the same long-winded sentence that he started in 1976.
do you think, you know, Roy stepping down, then that's the apocalypse? I mean, I feel like the world has kind of changed. You know, the last year might have been tough enough, but now Roy leaves and the whole thing absolutely falls apart.
Terrible news for me. I mean, I've been doing some ageist bullying of Roy Hodgson on Twitter for years now, and I'm going to have to find a new target. I mean, I worked out recently that when Roy Hodgson was born, Fred Everest was West Brom manager, and Fred Everest became West Brom manager in 1902, which either means that Roy Hodgson was born in 1902 or that Fred Everest was West Brom manager for a very, very long time.
I mean, the thing about Hodgson is, I've never met him. I don't know. He seems a real nice fella. I know Wilson speaks very highly of him. But there is an argument to be made that, and Tony Evans has actually made it in the past and got pelters for it, that he's criminally overrated as a manager, and that because he speaks more than two languages, and reads books, he's some sort of sophisticated genius, you know, which... And he can be very spiky. I'll never forget his when he resigned as England manager after that defeat, but turned up at the press conference and sort of said, "I don't even know why I'm here."
There was just I remember watching a game where it just wasn't fair. Like the camera angle wasn't fair, and Roy basically looked like Palace had conceded, I think it was Palace, I can't remember what it was, and he was just yelling, you know, presumably he was his assistant manager, but Ray Lewington wasn't there, and he just looked like he was just talking to a chair for quite a long time.
it's interesting times for Palace, actually, because they've no manager, and they've 16 players out of contract in a month's time. So, you know, the cupboard is at Sellers Park is going to be pretty bare this summer unless they do some serious wheeler dealing.
Let's do the playoffs then. Bournemouth beat Brentford 1-0. Swansea won 1-0 at Barnsley. You were at the Barnsley game, Richard. Man, I enjoyed just how direct Barnsley play football.
Yes, I mean, I think for you in particular, as a fan of John Beck's Cambridge, it would have been like transported back in time to the days when Steve Claridge got substituted for passing the ball sideways once. I mean, the thing is, this was the first time the Barnsley crowd had been in there since Valerian Ishmael took over, and they were really up for it. And part of it clearly is that they've had their most successful season for a long, long time. But part of it is that that direct style of football did energise them. And lots of people ran around kicking the ball forwards. And actually the goal came from a move where Swansea managed to go back and across before going forwards and had a moment of quality. And it felt like the moment where Swansea imposed themselves upon Barnsley. But the pass completion rates in that game apparently were 51% and 49%. So if Barnsley do come up, it could be a bit of a contrast of styles with some clubs in the Premier League. But when I got home, I did watch the highlights of the other game with Bournemouth and Brentford, and it did just look as though those were two more talented teams playing a more sophisticated brand of football. And before the playoffs, it did look as though the two best teams were in the same semi-final. And the first legs would seem to confirm that to me.
In League One, Blackpool beat Oxford 3-0 at the Kassam. Second leg is on Friday. Lincoln play Sunderland this evening. Are you buzzing, Barry?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm not particularly confident, though.
Thank you for that preview. Newport beat Forest Green 2-0. Second leg is on Sunday in League Two. Tranmere and Morecambe play on Thursday night. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we've got Barry's mailbag, any other business, and stats with Richard Jolly. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Bertie says, does Richard Jolly have a big spreadsheet or what? Barry, you don't want Richard to... You don't want to know the secrets.
No, I'd rather not... peek behind the curtain, but I suspect we are about to find out if he has a big spreadsheet. To be honest, I already know whether or not he has a spreadsheet, but it's not for me to say.
Do you have a big spreadsheet, Richard?
Disappointingly enough, no.
Right. So I'm interested in how much sort of preemptive, you know, are you ready? So we've got these games tonight in the Premier League, and we've got, you know, Everton Wolves and Burnley Liverpool and Palace Arsenal, etc. Have you got stats that are just ready to go at any time?
Not normally. I mean, tonight I'm actually going to Everton Wolves anyway, so I probably won't be doing any sort of random stats on the other games. But there's the odd thing I notice, but sometimes it's just reacting to what happens. I mean, for instance, the other day, I didn't have a bunch of stats lined up on the off chance that Alisson would score a goal for Liverpool. Some people do seem to think I have every potential scenario lined up in case the reserve left back scores a hat trick with his head. I don't. So things that I do actually about games are just tend to be observations from games that I try and check as quickly as possible. Some of the other stuff more during the week are just sort of observations that I may come across and which some people may find irrelevant, and indeed most people find irrelevant, but one or two people like.
What did you do before social media? Did you just tell the person next door?
Largely. Well, for years on social media, I did very little on that as well. But I would often try and actually research articles, which may surprise some people. But some of the stats, you write them in an article and nobody notices if it's 400 words down an article. And I'm talking about the more relevant footballing ones here, not the absolute nonsense, because the absolute nonsense would obviously get subbed out of any article by any half-decent sub. So it's a different format. And sometimes just the one stat taken in itself, people find interesting, whereas they just don't notice it in an article, which says something about short attention spans. And any journalist can confirm that when you tweet a link to an article, you'll get people replying with points you've already made in that article and which they haven't bothered to read.
I mean, I suppose the thing is people do like the nonsense is more fun, you know, because there's an obsession with stats at the moment, right? And I suppose some of them I find very sort of frustrating, you know, when it just constantly Sky Sports News telling you that Fabio Silva's average shot is from 12.4 yards away. You know, like, I just don't know why anybody would ever care. And I know there is a sort of relevance for, you know, people who look at stats when they're trying to buy players. But I think for fans, it's the nonsense that people want, I guess. Or maybe just for me. I don't know.
I hope so. I mean, I think partly that football should actually be fun, which is something people forget in some of the toxicness and the whataboutery and the echo chambers and the moaning about referees and the moaning about VAR. And a lot of what I do is not intended to be serious, but also it's just intended to make observations that hopefully are entertaining rather than anything else. Some of them make actual points about players or manager or clubs. Some of them are just complete irrelevant rubbish. And some of those are the ones that people like the most, as you say, because to a certain extent, you get loads of stats on Sky and Opta and anything anyway. For something to stand out, maybe it has to be a bit different.
Do you, well, I'm heartened to learn that you don't have a spreadsheet. I suspect you may have a calendar in that. So say if the anniversary of Elvis's death is coming up, you're really hoping Stephen Presley will score that day because you'll be able to make something, mine some gold out of it.
Yeah, I have actually used Stephen Presley and Elvis Presley more than once. I've used Neil Lennon and John Lennon more than once. I've spent 18 months pretending that Kyle Walker is a goalkeeper and several years linking Roy Hodgson's age to virtually anything. During lockdown, before it got far too long and the number of days would have been depressing, I did actually manage to work out pretty much every day how long lockdown had lasted in comparison to managerial reigns at various clubs. Most obviously Brian Clough's 44 days at Leeds United. So there is that. And one, 2 or 3 years ago, that I don't know how I thought of this, but I had to work out the exact day and I did a couple of weeks in advance, was when I noticed that it would soon be the case that James Milner had been a Premier League player for exactly half his life. And I had to do the exact number of days. But the good news is, if you get something like that wrong, no one will ever know because no one else has ever checked it.
Are you in a relationship, Richard?
Oddly enough, no.
What? And what's been your most successful, like in terms of sort of, you know, what's gone the most viral, or what's your favourite that you've come up with?
Well, the one that's gone the most viral was when I said that Dominic Cummings had travelled further with coronavirus in lockdown than Crewe Alexandra had ever been for a competitive game in their entire history.
I think we read that one out. That is very good. Well, look, thank you, Richard, for doing them all, because, you know, sometimes I just get them because I've seen them, but sometimes I do, you know, I check what you've done. But we do always credit you, and I presume that, you know,
unlike
we're allowed
some
to just read out everything you've tweeted.
Yeah, yes, not everyone credits them, it has to be said.
Right, now, Karim Benzema is back in the France squad after almost 5 years out. Producer Joel saying their squad is already ridiculous. This feels almost unfair. Kylian Mbappe tweeted out a picture, you know, with KM plus KB equals fire. I think that's what it was. And all I did was felt sorry for Olivier Giroud, because he's not, it's KB multiplied by KM is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 fire emojis. But I mean, he's such, they are going to be so good, aren't they? Kieran says, France are favourites for Eurovision and joint favourites for the Euros. Do they have the best chance of getting the much coveted and never before done Euro double? If not them, who else has a shot at it? You know, well, that's something to stick in your calendar there, Richard. When it happens.
Quick question on Benzema. It's like he left the French squad very much under a cloud. Will he be welcomed back warmly by his fellow players?
Are you asking me?
Well, I'm asking anyone who might know, because I don't. But
the response I've seen amongst French fans and some of the French players has been quite warm. He's a very popular figure amongst general French football people. There's only a handful regarding the case that really went the opposite way. But generally, I'm led to believe that he's a very popular and well-liked person.
Hopefully, they'll all get along famously. Ernesto Hernandez has gone on holiday, the Norwich player. The Daily Mail interviewed him without any idea who he was, which led to a brilliant article in the Daily Mail saying, Onel Hernandez, 28, arrived in Faro with his fiancée, Kirsha, 27, her sister Hazel, 18, and their daughter Dreamy, 2. Dreamy is a good, strong name, isn't it? The family revealed they were staying for 2 weeks and had been saving up all year for the break. Onel, who lives in Norwich, said, it's great to be back on holiday and something we've really missed. The one good thing about the lockdown is it gave me a chance to save some money for a decent family holiday. Presumably he's on enough a week to go on holiday whenever he likes. Yes, Richard.
Brilliant one a few years ago when the BBC went around doing a vox pop and they went up to an old man on the street and said, do you remember the 1967 Merseyside Derby? And he replied, yes, I played in it. And the next question was, oh, who are you? And he said, Tommy Lawrence, I was the Liverpool goalkeeper.
Yeah, it's an amazing video, isn't it?
There's a similar one as well with a vox pop about the fortunes of Ipswich Town being conducted on the streets of Ipswich, and the reporter collared Kieran Dyer, and who was an Ipswich midfielder at the time, and asked him, you know, what do you think of how Ipswich's season is going, or who should be the new manager or whatever, or, you know, are you an Ipswich fan? And Dyer goes, yeah, I play for them. Cue a very embarrassed reporter having to do like the guy with Tommy Lawrence going, oh, what's your name? Would I have heard of you?
Chris says, with two games to go and three teams level on points, if Fola win their game in hand, who do you think will win the league in Luxembourg this year? Jordan, are you going for F91 Diddling, Swift Hesper, or CS Fola Esch?
F91 for sure. They're the favourites. They've got a really good front man, really good back line. Yeah.
In Copa Libertadores news, River Plate have confirmed that they have had 25 positive COVID cases. They wanted to add goalkeepers to their squad. CONMEBOL have rejected their appeal to add an additional goalkeeper. So their manager will be forced to start an outfield player in goal against Independiente Santa Fe tomorrow. Reports fullback Milton Casco will be the man between the sticks. They've only got 10 players. I mean, it's, you know, the serious side is, you know, is COVID in South America is really out of control. I speak to Tim Vickery once a week on the radio, and but I'll talk to him about that. But I did prep you, Richard, to ask if an outfield player had ever started a game in goal before.
Yeah, I think the last example I could find was Alain Giresse, the great French midfielder who won Euro 1984. When Bordeaux were in a protest about having their goalkeeper banned, they not only put Alain Giresse in goal, but didn't name him as the goalkeeper, thus meaning that apparently he wasn't allowed to use his hands anyway. And he conceded 5 goals and they swapped him over and let another outfield player go in goal, who presumably also wasn't able to use his hands. But the whole thing does make me wonder if we've got the emphasis completely wrong. We've been talking about all these footballing goalkeepers in recent years, people like Alisson and Edison, and how they can pass the ball. And surely what we actually needed was goalkeeping central midfielders and goalkeeping fullbacks, who, if all of your goalkeepers were suddenly ruled out, you could go and put them in goal. And as Barry may recall, the Republic of Ireland's third choice goalkeeper in the 1990 World Cup was actually Niall Quinn. Most teams took 3 goalkeepers. The Irish only took 2 plus Niall Quinn.
I did interview a goalkeeper yesterday who plays for Wigginton Grasshoppers, and they were playing Yarm, and he's called Jordan Holt. And he was playing in a semi-final last week. They were 2-0 down, and he went up for a corner in the last minute and scored a header. And then he went up for another corner and he scored another header, taking it to extra time. It went straight to penalties. In the penalty shootout, he scored and saved a penalty, but still lost. But that is quite the scenes amongst the Wigginton Grasshoppers players was quite something, by all accounts, when he scored his second. He was marked as well, unlike Alisson. Now, to Barry's mailbag. Here's an email we got, Barry. Subject, your tickets for Nigel Farage, America's Comeback Tour 2021, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Barry, you have successfully got 2 free tickets for Nigel Farage performing in Pittsburgh in 2021. So you can save the tickets to your phone. I'm not sure of the exact date because I haven't, but there you go. Thank you to whoever signed Barry up for that.
Wasn't that yesterday and about six people turned up?
Oh, right. Was that it? Oh, well, that's probably why they were expecting eight. They put out food for you, right, Barry. You didn't turn up.
I'm sorry. No, I think it was more than... I think maybe it was about 18, but it turned out six of the 18 were part of Nigel Farage's entourage. And just the notion that Nigel Farage has a six-man entourage is quite something.
Here's an email from Patrick in Wellington, New Zealand. I don't know if I buy this. And I'm, you know... We're talking about a lot of people crashing their car while listening to the podcast. He says, while attempting to reverse down my drive and listening to the pod, I put the car into the wrong gear and accelerated up a bank, flipping the car onto its roof. All three emergency services had to be called and the car was a write-off, but I emerged unscathed. Annoyingly, the podcast kept playing throughout, so I had to listen to it all over again from the beginning. I'm starting to get sceptical. Anyway, thank you. I'm glad you're okay, Patrick. And I'm sorry for my scepticism. And David says, hello, my name is David. I'm an American. I listen to every pod. Finally, I have a chance to let Barry know how I really feel. This is footballweekly@theguardian.com. I love you, Barry, and continue being a sourpuss for all our pleasure. Up the Reds and up Barry's ass. Bye, David. Thank you, David.
Crikey.
I think, Barry.
That's the most affection anyone's shown me in a very, very long time.
Well, look, that's a lovely way to end it. Thank you for your time, Jordan.
Anytime, mate.
Much love to our fans in Uganda. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Max.
Come back on again if you'd like to.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Great. And Barry, come back. I mean, you'll come back whether you're asked or not, won't you? I'll see you. I'll see you on Monday.
Tomorrow?
No, tomorrow. What's happening? What day
Today's
is it?
Wednesday. Oh, we're on dear. Tomorrow. Yes. Oh, and we've a live Euro preview online on the 10th of June at, I think, 7:30. So tickets are a very reasonably priced £7.
£7. You don't have to leave your house. Me, you, Jonathan Wilson, Lars Sivertsen. Plans already in place for a halftime spectacular and other interesting live elements. Buy tickets, come and watch us, and we will be back, thank you, tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.